that, you know, it didn't go the way it did, but it did.
So, the people from the city who'd buy second homes here, tell me about them.
Well, the people, second homeowners in the area now are the, you know, bring a lot of money to the area. They come up on weekends, they come up there in the summertime. They come up, sometimes some of them come up in the wintertime to use the, you know, to ski and snowmobile. Back in the 80s and the early 90s when the, you know, the big land boom was going on, and, you know, farmers that were selling off their property got good money for their land, which, you know, is good and bad, I guess.
Yeah.
And they just had the big go-around with Meridale Farms. They didn't want that to be subdivided, but eventually the developer went out, and that's going to be subdivided. But... you know, the second homeowner, the downstate person, or whatever you want to call them, bring a lot of money into the area now.
Yeah.
They pay a lot of taxes, which helps keep the town going.
So how do they interact with the longtime residents?
Oh, for the most part, they interact well.
Okay.
You know, they seem to... for the most part, they all seem to want to be part of the community. They all seem to be good neighbors. And there's, you know, you hear a few stories of people not getting along, but for the most part, they seem to get along well with everybody.
Okay.
We have some for neighbors here that, you know, couldn't ask for better neighbors. You know, they came up on the weekends. They come up once in a while for a couple weeks in the summer. And, yeah. You know.
So in addition to having less dairy farms and more second homeowners, in what ways has the community changed over the years?
Well, those are the biggest changes, the dairy farmers and the second homeowners moving in. You know, the rural roads have gotten better, so it's easier to travel on them. You know, it's hard to say, you know, it's, I don't know.
Okay. And you said there wasn't much that the farmers could do when it was becoming harder and harder to keep the farms. But was there ever any attempt to try and organize something like a political movement? Or...
Well, there was lots of movements. My father was big into Eastern milk producers and went to Washington a few times to rally, you know, for the milk prices and to rally for feed prices. And there's always been, you know, groups of farmers from the local area that, you know, stand up for their rights and try to get milk prices higher and keep the feed prices and fuel prices down so that they can stay in business. But yeah, back in when my father was in dairy farming, there was a lot of activity as far as representation for the local dairy farmer.
Yeah. What other sort of work did your father do to help local dairy farmers?
Well, you know, he was a member of Eastern Milk Producers, and I'm trying to think what else. I can't think right off the top of my head. But I know he went to New York City quite a lot on a few trips, and actually my mother and I went along on a couple. He did go to Washington a few times with some of the local with some of the other local farmers and to try to rally the government. But I don't think they ever made out very well, but as things went the way they did. But at least they were heard.
How did this affect your own decision to enter politics?
To enter what?
Politics.
How did it affect my... Well, my father was always into politics. He was a big Republican supporter. I can remember as a kid growing up always having Barry Goldwater and different posters around that he would distribute every time there was a major election. He was the Justice of the Peace for quite a few years. He was on the town board. He was on the school board. He was always into politics, and I guess that's where, you know, my interest came, I guess.
Yeah.
From, you know, the work that he did.
So, what sort of things have you done in your political activity?
In my political, you know, I participate when they have, you know, the Lincoln Day dinners. I always go to those. And they have the annual, you know, picnics and pig roasts in the summer. I go to those. We have had quite a few fundraisers for different candidates here at our house. For numerous, actually, for senators and for assemblymen and for judges and try to get people to know, local people to know, to be come out and meet the candidates and see what they're all about.
Yeah.
And it's been fairly successful.
So what motivated you to make your recent run for office?
Just the fact that, you know, I wanted to get involved in local government, and now that I'm retired from, you know, the administrative work of the Office of Children and Family Services, I felt I had a lot of experience, you know, with people and you know, how to run big business, and I just thought it was, you know, the right time to do that.
I thought,
you know, I had a lot to offer the townspeople, and, you know, and the experience that I gained over the last 10 years working for the Office of Children and Family Services, and, you know, being the director of large facilities and small facilities, and the counseling part that I did, and, you know, in some of those places, the one facility I worked at, it was over 320 staff, you know, so I know how to deal with people.
And tell me more about Child and Family Services. And the work you did there?
Well, I started out as a youth division aide, which is a person that pretty much watches the juvenile delinquent boys in the facility and their daily activities. And then I moved into the counselor position, where you had a unit full of 20 kids. It was your responsibility to, you know, to do all their casework and the court work and counsel them, and you were pretty much the liaison between the family and the facility. And the senior counselor position was overseeing counselors, and as a senior counselor, I did a lot of the community service work. We did fundraising work, reestablished the drum corps at the facility. I was the head of the community service. I also did a lot of work with a gentleman from Cornell to establish programs that taught young men how to prepare themselves for the work world. And we had three or four different programs that he developed and him and I implemented in the facilities. As a director and assistant director and director, you know, you oversaw all the different departments that were you know, from your medical to your mental health to the recreation to education to the general supervision of the line staff. It was a challenging job, especially when it got to the bigger facilities, and that agency was always changing and very heavy in paperwork, and so there was a lot of responsibilities as I grew up through the agency.
What were the hardest parts of doing that job?
No, paperwork was one of the hardest because it was a never ending supply. I guess when you have a lot of people, you have a lot of attitudes, and you have a lot of different ideas, and you have a lot of. And when you're working with juvenile delinquent boys, there's always, you never could say you saw it all, because as soon as you said that, the next day something else would happen that you at least expected. Some of the challenging parts were, you know, getting everybody's attitude in the same line, and just working with different types of people.
Do you have any stories about a time when there was a particularly difficult interpersonal conflict going on?
There's plenty of them. There's plenty and plenty and plenty of them. It was just, you know, it was an everyday, probably maybe not an everyday, but fairly close to that, you know, when the kids and the staff would have differences of opinions and they'd have to go in and put fires out all the time. I mean, all the staff were different. Some staff could handle the kids without any problems, and there was other ones that just kept starting fires all the time, you know. I can remember one time that we had a discrete mental health unit at the one facility that I worked at. Every now and then, there was like 10 or 12 kids there, every now and then that they would get all worked up, get all fired up, and you'd have to go out and straighten them out and talk to them. And I was able to do that pretty good because the kids liked me. In fact, one kid said one night, after we got things settled down, he said, "Mr. Kelso, the one thing we like about you is you always come out and talk to us. You might not say what we want to hear or what we want to hear, but you always come out and talk to us. That's why we respect you, and that's why when you come out here, we quiet down."
That's good. Yeah.
But, you know, there was always a lot of, you know, interpersonal relationships between kids and staff and kids and teachers, and it was always interesting.
I'd imagine so.
That was always interesting. It was another adult moment.
What kind of work did you do before you went into child and family services?
I was a meat cutter for a couple years. I did both wholesale end and retail end of that. I drove truck for a while. What else did I do? Those are the two jobs that I had, I guess, prior to, you know, high school and a couple years of college that I went to was, you know, I worked in a slaughterhouse over in Bloomville, and both the kill floor and in the meat processing part of it. I worked there for a couple, 3 years, and I worked in a meat market in Bloomville where they did retail. And then I drove truck for a couple years. And right after, when I was still driving truck, is when I got hired to work at the Office of Children and Family Services.
So, tell me more about the slaughterhouse and what that was like.
Yeah. You know, it was always busy. He started at 7 o'clock in the morning, and a lot of nights I didn't get done, and a couple of my friends that worked there, we didn't get done until 10, 11 o'clock at night because we, he worked all day, and then they had to have somebody to load the trucks at night to go, that were taking the meat to the city. So we pretty much did all that. It was, you know, a learning experience, how the animals are killed and how they're processed. And I worked in the boning room for a year or two where, you know, you learn to cut some meat, you learn how to bone meat, you learn, you know, all the process of that, which kind of prepared me for when I went to the retail end of it, working out of a, you know, a grocery store meat market type cutter. And I still do that today. We still cut up our own deer. We still cut up people's beef for them once in a while. And, you know, it's something that you don't forget how to do, I guess, when you did it for a couple of years, even though it was 40 years ago. But it was a good job. And, you know, the guy that, the family that owned the slaughterhouse there were nice people and took good care of you. Yeah. I left a couple times, and whenever I wanted to get the job back, I just went back, and they gave me my job back. And, so it was kind of interesting.
Yeah. And what about the meat retail? What was that like?
That was a store in Bloomville that they had a few groceries there, but the main part of the business was just all meat. There was two brothers owned it, and we had a couple ladies that wrapped meat full time. We took in custom cut meat, meat that farmers killed, their own. And, you know, they met a lot of interesting people. The farmers coming in, and the place had a reputation of having good meat. The gentleman that owned it went to Albany once a week and bought, you know, USDA choice and prime meats, and people knew that they knew how to cut it right there, and would cut it to how they wanted it, which is a big thing for a lot of people. They want the meat cut how they want to cut. And they had a reputation for doing that for quite a few years. And again, they took in a lot of custom cut stuff. So we were always busy there.
So then how did you come to get a job as a truck driver?
Well, they kind of scaled back. You know, the brothers kind of had some problems between themselves, and the one that owned the business wanted to sell it, and so they kind of scaled back. And a friend of mine had a dump truck that he needed to have a driver for, so I went to work for him for a couple summers.
And how do you go from driving a dump truck to Child and Protective Services?
Well, at the time, there wasn't a lot of turnover in South Core right at the facility. And a couple of my friends got jobs there, and, well, they told me about it. And at the time, I was about 25 years old, and one of my goals in life, I guess, was to have a job that would eventually have a retirement from and had medical benefits and you know, stuff that if you were looking at the other end of your life, you kind of wanted to prepare yourself for. So, and they're, you know, and they paid good at the time. That was, you know, a better paying job in the area. Even though I think when I started, the annual salary was $8,600 a year. 1978. But, you know, the benefits, the medical benefits and the retirement were the big thing if you were thinking about 30 years down the road.
Yeah.
And that was the main reason why I went there. That, and I knew the guy that was the director there because his son was a year ahead of me in school, and I think his daughter was a year behind me in school. So we were very familiar with the man that ran it, and he hired us local people to work there for him.
Okay.
He always said he hired the local juvenile delinquents to watch a juvenile delinquent.
Well, tell me some about what kind of work did you do on your father's farm?
Well, we had a huge farm for back in the 60s. We milked over 200 cows. And again, you know, my father was kind of a pioneer in the agricultural industry. We went to a freestall barn. We went to one of the first ones to have the freestall barn, one of the first ones to have the milking parlor in the area. You know, I did the chores that normal kids would do, you know. We grew up, you know, wanted to drive a tractor, and as soon as we got big enough to drive a tractor, we drove tractors and mowed hay and raked hay and baled hay. And we didn't do much of the corn work because that started after it was time to go back to school. The people, the men that worked for us did a lot of that. And we built fence. One of the jobs in the summer was to check the dry cows to see if any of them had freshened and bring the cows and calves back to the barn. And, you know, get the cows in the barn in the morning. We did a lot of milking. It was just, there was always something to do when you had a dairy farm the size that we had. There was always something to do.
And how big was that dairy farm?
Well, at one time we milked 225 cows. 225 cows, and we always had, probably 50 or 60 dry cows, so there was lots of things to do.
Did you use machinery to milk the cows, or, well?
Did we use machinery?
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a double eight milking parlor. It was one of the first ones in the area. You really had to have that to milk that amount of cows. You know, it was always interesting.
And how did that farm work change over time for you?
Well, you know, as time went on, I mean, went to milking in the conventional barn with a milk pail and pipeline and to milking in the milking parlor. And of course, as you went along, you know, your machinery got a little bit more modern, as far as, you know, instead of baling the hay on the ground, the balers kicked it in the wagon, kicked the bales in the wagon, and instead of pulling in the barn to throw hay off in the mows, you had elevators to get it up in there, and, you know, the tractors got more powerful and more options on them, and again, went from the conventional barn to the freestall barn, which enabled you to milk more cows and do it more effectively. And put in, you know, conveyors to take the grains or take the feed out of the silos and take them out to the barns to feed the cows, so you didn't have to do that with a wheelbarrow and shovel anymore. And there was many ways that as the years went by to progress to make things easier.
Yeah. So how do you manage to maintain your farm when so many in the area were going under?
What was that?
Sorry. How is it that you managed to maintain your farm while so many others in the area went under?
Well, I think a lot of it, you know, at the time, you had to get bigger. And a lot of the smaller farmers are going out just because they didn't, you know. There were some farms that just weren't as good as others as far as land goes, the way the land laid. And, you know, people chose not to get bigger. They chose to go out of business instead of getting bigger just because they didn't want the headaches. You know, and it's like, I guess it's like every business. Some farmers weren't as good of farmers as other farmers. And, you know, some of the decisions they made probably cost them some money. But in those days, it was, when my father, when we sold our farm, it was, you know, most everybody was either getting bigger or getting out of it.
So what were the circumstances under which you sold your farm?
What's that?
What were the circumstances under which you sold your farm?
Well, At the time I was 17 years old, my father asked me if I wanted to farm, if I wanted to be a farmer, and at the time I didn't. So I basically told him that I didn't want to be a farmer, and I guess if he wanted to sell the farm and move on, that's probably the best thing he could do. And it's at, that's the time that he sold the farm and actually went down and started at the mill. Purchased the mill property and restored that. So it was pretty much my decision to, that I didn't want to be a farmer, which I wish I had that decision to make over again. I think I would have done a little different. But at the time, we had over, we owned over 2,000 acres, and with today's technologies and everything, it probably wouldn't have been the worst thing in the world to have done.
So how did you come to change your mind about farming?
I just didn't. One of the things, I guess, was, you know, it was hard to get good help. It's a seven, at the time it was a 7-day, and it still is a 7-day a week job. You know, I mean, you have to be there all the time, and I just didn't, at that point in time, want to do that. I didn't want those headaches. And
Now it sounds like you would enjoy farming, and you have some animals here, so how did you come to want to start farming again?
Well, I guess once it wasn't there, you know, you kind of realized how you missed it, you know? How you missed the, you know, the freedom to do what you want to do when you want to do it, and, you know, I mean, nobody's, you're your own boss, you do things the way you want to do it. You know, I like the field work. I like to be outdoors. I don't like to be indoors in the summertime. I don't like it out anymore in the wintertime outside. But it's part of it. But I just miss the, you know, operating machinery and working with the animals, and you know, those are the kind of things that I like too. The operating machinery part of it is a big part.
What would you say is your favorite machine to operate?
Mowing hay. I love to mow hay. I can mow hay day after day after day.
Well, tell me about mowing hay.
Well, you're by yourself in big fields, and you see a lot of wildlife, and you see a lot of animals, and you know, you got time to, you know, do a lot of thinking. You got time. It's, you know, you're kind of by yourself and doing your own thing. You know, you got a big field, and figure out the quickest, the easiest way to mow it, and then when you get done with it, you feel a sense of accomplishment. And I don't know, you know, everybody has their own favorite things they like to do. When we had our farm, when I got 14-15 years old, I did all our mowing at the time, and I guess it was just something that I always did. I still like to do it. I do all the mowing up on the bee farm where I work now. I pretty much mow all the hay.
So how did you come to start working at that farm where you work now?
Well, the guy bought the farm and needed, you know, another guy to help out. And at the time, you know, I was retired, and we were looking for a little more income, and he offered a pretty decent starting wage, so it was really kind of hard to turn down. And they offered me to, you know, hired me to do all the machinery operating and the stuff that I like to do. So, you know, I'll give it a try.
So, what lessons have you learned from farming? Life lessons, possibly some academic ones.
What's that now?
Yeah. What kind of lessons have you learned from doing farming? It could be life lessons or any other sort, academic ones.
What kind of lessons have I learned?
Yeah.
Well, I guess the one lesson you learned, there's always something to do. And, you know, and when you're on a farm, there's never runs out of work to do.